Hello and welcome to the MMQB podcast. This is the Thursday show. We really don't have a name for it yet, but what we are doing this week is something a little bit different and something we'll probably try with some consistency going forward. We are going to kind of deep dive and talk about a major feature we had on the MMQB and in Sports Illustrated recently. This is the first time we're really trying it with sort of a non-X's and O's football story, though there are a little bit of X's and O's in this one, but we're going to be talking about Dalvin Cook, and I'm going to be joined in just a second by Kaylin Kaler, who authored the story. I helped her out with the edit here, but if you haven't seen it, the headline, if you want to use the old Ask Jeeves to look it up, The Rise of Dalvin Cook, What Happened When the Red Flags Stopped Waving. Just to set this up, I want to tell you about how we sort of arrived on why we did this story and things like that. This is a bit of a sequel to a piece that Robert Klemko did a couple years ago, which I also edited. Dalvin Cook coming up in the draft in 2017, lots of red flags, and it sort of spiraled out of control a little bit. He had six run-ins with the law during his teenage years. The most explosive one was an accusation that while he was at Florida State, he had punched a woman outside a bar in Tallahassee. He was acquitted, actually in very short time by a jury. A lot of the other stuff was you know, things from high school. There was a lot of smoke, though. Teams were very uncomfortable. And essentially what happened during the pre-draft process was at some point, he had gotten on the wrong side of a runner, sort of a middleman, sort of unaffiliated recruiter for agents, and this runner started spreading. Some of the rumors were so insane we didn't report them because we didn't want to give them any legs whatsoever. They were completely fabricated. The one we did run with a little bit and report out as best we could was he was spreading a rumor that was getting to teams that Dalvin Cook was basically showing up late to all of his workouts, and sometimes he had alcohol on his breath, and the folks we talked to who were working with Dalvin Cook pre-draft said that is completely fabricated, that there is absolutely no truth to that, et cetera, et cetera. But really, some of the red flags that, and there were legitimate ones, but they sort of got exacerbated by this sort of scummy runner-type character. If you want to read that original story, which is kind of the prequel to the one we're about to talk about, that is Dalvin Cook and the Stories Behind the Red Flags. That's an April 2017 story. But yeah, I mean, essentially, this is the story of how Dalvin Cook fell in the draft, why he fell in the draft, why the Vikings were comfortable with him, and sort of a bigger discussion of how teams sort of vet these guys and why they end up feeling kind of good about some guys, not so good about other guys, and why it's, I don't know, an inexact science, to put it as kindly as possible. But with that meandering intro, let me introduce Kaylin Kaler, the writer on the story. Kaylin, how are you? I'm doing well. This was one of my favorite stories of the season, of all time, but mostly of the season because that's what I can remember at this point. I forgot everything before 2018 or so. But I do want to just start with sort of the whole pre-draft process in general, and I guess my first question to you is, what was this like for Dalvin in the late winter and spring of 2017, when he is declared for the draft, coming out of Florida State after his junior year, and he's sort of going through this grueling process?
Yeah, Dalvin's personality makes this process really hard for him. You can tell just within a few seconds of being around him. He's naturally an introvert. He's very withdrawn. He's kind of, and I think this is part of sort of his upbringing in a rough part of Miami where, you know, he was always had to kind of look out for himself. He's very, a little bit closed off and slow to trust people who aren't close to him already. Mm-hmm. So if you can imagine having that mindset and having that instinct as a person, and then going into the draft process where you have to repeat yourself and repeat yourself and repeat yourself and 32 times. Basically, all 32 teams are asking you the exact same questions, looking for the same thing out of you. And sometimes the questions get a little weird and personal, and particularly with someone like him who had six questionable incidents, legal run-ins in his past, six separate events in his past that he was being asked about. And for someone who's already like slow to trust others, that would be really hard to address those things to people you don't know, because all of these NFL teams, all of these scouts and GMs are total strangers to Dalvin. And so, yeah, he wants a job in the NFL, and you have to go through this to get a job in the NFL, especially for someone with his talent. So he had to address these things, but it was tough for him. When I asked him what the process was like for him, he just kind of let out a long sigh as if like just bringing up the word like pre-draft process was enough to just totally bring him back to that whole, you know, 2 month period of time from January to I guess it's longer than 2 months, from January to April essentially, where you're being poked and prodded and everything. So you could just tell from his reaction when I first asked him about it, like how much he was not comfortable during that whole time. And, you know, when I talked to some scouts who had actually personally spoke to him in that process, one Southeast area scout who did a lot of work on him because their team was interested in him and their team probably would have drafted him had the Vikings not. This guy basically told me, he said, you know, he was really evasive. He was really closed off and guarded. You didn't feel good about any of it, him being mature enough. There wasn't a domestic charge, but you knew the player would need a lot of maintenance. So you felt like you wanted to take every measure. And I think when a player like Dalvin, who has episodes in his past that need to be addressed, I think NFL teams are really just looking for you to explain yourself. I don't think they necessarily need to be convinced that you're innocent or convinced that, you know, I don't know. I don't think they need to walk away from it being like, oh, wow, he was wrongfully put into that situation. That's so unfair. I think they're literally just looking for you to own up to it, say what happened, tell your side of the story, and be open about it and like be able to talk about it. And I think with Dalvin, he wasn't. And he probably just kind of shrugged off getting into details, because even when I was trying to ask him about specific episodes from his past, he really did not want to discuss any of them in detail, which is totally understandable because at this point that was, you know, 5 years ago, all of these things. So he's trying to move past it now. But, you know, I think a reason maybe teams were not comfortable with taking him in the first round is because he didn't give them the closure and didn't give them that openness that they're really looking for when they ask you about the things that you've done wrong in your past.
I know it seems like a really, really straightforward playbook. And I don't know if this is, I mean, look, I don't have to worry about drafting these guys for my team. None of them will come play on my flag football team or anything. It's like if you are one of these guys who have gotten the, you know, the metaphorical red flags, the only course of action you have, and it seems like this is how they're all coached to do it, is you have to go in there, you have to basically give a full confession, and then just, you know, sort of promise you won't do anything like this again. And it doesn't really matter if you meet it or not. You just have to give this
right.
performative sort of I've learned my lesson type of thing, and that allows teams to like check a box. I mean, there are other things, but it seems like as far as the interviews go, you know, teams do psychological testing and things like that, and obviously they will ask around the people around you to get a better sense of you. But it seems like it's this just kind of silly, straightforward thing where like you just have to say like, oh, I did all this stuff. Sorry, won't do it again.
Right, right. I think you're totally right. And the one other interesting thing that the scout told me was that, you know, we were kind of, I mean, there's, it's so weird, but there's like varying levels of red flags, right? Mm-hmm. Like things are more serious and certain crimes and allegations are more serious than others. And this scout was telling me, like, he said, I didn't think he was ever going to embarrass the franchise. So that's, I think, kind of the standard for teams is like, are you going to do something that's going to really put our brand and our team at risk, our image, essentially? So this guy, his impression based off of like all the things in Dalvin's past, he didn't think it was going to be an issue where it was going to end up embarrassing the franchise later down the line. And in that earlier quote, you know, he mentioned there was no domestic charge. So that's kind of another, I guess, a bar, a level of a red flag. So, yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. And then, you know, Dalvin also, I think he signed with a very young agent who didn't have a ton of experience before working with Dalvin. And I think that it was not helpful because I think a more veteran agent has been through this before with other players who have similar backgrounds and similar question marks. Yeah. And there are a lot of ways that you can get out in front of it just by coaching them to be more expansive. And, you know, maybe you do a story where you get some positive PR out there. So there's like ways you can get in front of it that I think he didn't necessarily do. And then he also didn't have a great combine. He didn't have a great workout. So I think that also just physically didn't help him much either.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned the fact that his camp had so much trouble sort of countering these things because, again, when we first looked into Dalvin back in 2017 and lead up to this, we were hearing things from teams that usually don't make it all the way to teams or don't get taken seriously.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like... we were going on gut instinct a little bit based on what we knew on him. We didn't necessarily want to defend him if he wasn't worthy of being defended. But the stuff that was getting thrown around about him was just like, it was crazy. It was insane stuff that was so obviously untrue. And he really took a beating during draft season.
Yeah, and part of it is like you'd have to be on the defense. You have to be playing defense a little bit if you have a player like that who is being the subject of rumors because he already had things in his past that make it an easier jump to like spread other rumors about him. Yeah.
I want to jump ever so briefly into a Packers story you did a year ago, and I'll explain why it's so related. You've had a good year, Kalen Kaler. Good calendar year.
Thank
here.
You.
Last year, you did the sort of definitive story on how it all unraveled for the McCarthy, Rodgers, Packers. If you want to, dear listener, go back and look for that one. It's how it all went wrong in Packerland. But I want to pull up one thing that was in there because we talked a little bit about how teams sort of differentiate between the quote unquote red flag guys and some of them. Some kind of don't. I'll let you take this, Kalen. But you talked about you wrote about in that piece the Packers and what they referred to as loud guys.
Yeah. So the Packers used two different terms, which I found out from my reporting. They would call. So they were very much a team culture and environment that was like conform, like we accept nothing else. Like mm-hmm. There is not really a lot of individuality there, and it's very bland. It was very bland and like very just not a lot of expression going on at the time. So they used the term loud guys, which basically referred to anybody who is either talking too much to the media and sharing things that were like borderline insidery. And it also could refer to someone who just was literally privately complaining amongst the team. Like yeah. A loud guy could be someone who was actually out there in public, or it could be somebody who was just, you know, complaining inside the locker room. But even that was something they really didn't like there. And then they used the term bad guys, which is just like a hilarious, simplified way to put it. But the term bad guy they threw around to describe, and that was the one that was sort of just like this umbrella bucket term that could be anything from a player who talks too much. So, you know, includes the loud guys there. And an example of that in Packerland was Martellus Bennett when they signed him. And he's obviously very expressive and very outgoing, and so that rubbed people wrong there. And you know, one of my sources for that story said, like, yeah, that was never gonna work. Like, they just knew from the get-go, like, that was not going to work in Green Bay. So that was kind of interesting. But yeah, so a bad guy could be a loud guy, but it could also be someone who, like, literally has committed a crime. It kind of ran the whole gamut there. So in terms of Dalvin, like, Dalvin would probably qualify for them as like a bad guy because, you know, he has, you know, he wasn't ever really charged with anything, but he had all these separate legal run-ins. So yeah, I think that's just really interesting that there's just this perception just of, you know, let's just lump them all together. You know, they're just all bad guys.
Yeah,
that's what they are.
Yeah. And we should clarify that that was the Ted Thompson era as a general manager in Green Bay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So kind of the opposite of that. And I want to briefly touch on this because we've discussed it. And I know I've discussed it with a couple other people in the office. Kind of the opposite of well, it's still lumping people together, but just sort of in a different way. You look at a team like the Browns, and in the past, year and a half now, they brought in a handful of guys, and I want to highlight three of them here. One being Antonio Callaway, another Desmond Harrison, two rookies, and then obviously they ended up signing Kareem Hunt when the Chiefs let him go after he was caught on tape in an altercation, not legally, but I think in the general sense, assaulting a young woman at the end of a late night. These are three guys who kind of had very different challenges. Hunt, you could kind of look at and say, okay, this is a guy who is out late, probably drinking too much and doing regrettable things, and maybe we can find a way to work around this because it's some sort of like impulse control issue with him or something like that. Antonio Callaway had a series of very troubling things that happened at the University of Florida. He was eventually, I mean, he didn't play his final year there. He was, for all intents and purposes, done with the program after he was ensnared as part of this credit card fraud scheme with eight other players. But before that, he had, among other things, also been accused of sexual assault. Now, he was cleared by the University of Florida. However, the accuser boycotted the hearing because the university appointed a Florida football booster to oversee the case, and she thought it was a farce and decided not to participate in it. But that that lawyer ended up finding Callaway had not done anything wrong. Desmond Harrison was a guy who was, again, like Callaway, an early round talent. He had been kicked out of the University of Texas, ended up at, I believe it was West Georgia Division II school. They signed him as an undrafted free agent. He was their starting left tackle at the beginning of 2018. He was during the season. He lost his job to Greg Robinson. He was still on the roster. They let him go last summer after he missed a team flight, but he soon after he was let go, he ended up being he turned himself in on a felony assault charge, felony assault and strangulation, a woman he was dating in North Carolina. These are three guys that they brought in, and John Dorsey gave the quote when they drafted Antonio Callaway, and I want to make sure I have this this quote up here. So Dorsey's quote was, "Let him get and develop a trust mechanism for the organization. Let him be ingrained in what it means to be a Cleveland Brown. Once you get him involved in that type of culture, good things can happen." Now, Kareem Hunt is still there. Callaway and Harrison are not. Callaway was let go. I guess he was habitually late and also had a drug suspension coming up, and they cut ties with him. But it's sort of this. Those are three guys who needed kind of very specific help. They were you could call them quote unquote bad guys, but to sort of just drop them in and say like, well, culture will fix them, that didn't seem reasonable.
No, and this is like the part about, I guess, sports in general that kind of like hurts my brain when you think about it too hard, because it's like, you know, culture I think is a real thing in a team, and it comes from the people in charge, from the head coach a lot of the times. And I do think, like in Dalvin's case, the Vikings did consciously surround him with players and coaches who were able to really help him and really support him. And so I think there's a lot of truth to that, and there's a lot that you can solve and fix by doing that. But like, by just saying like, and I don't know what the Browns did in Callaway's case. Like, I don't know if he was working really closely, or any of those three players. I don't know if they were working really closely with the player engagement director, or like what the actual system of support around them was. But like, just to say like, Browns culture, yeah, we got it, we handled it. After we've seen their team culture this year, completely, I mean, they're one of the most, they appear to be one of the most undisciplined teams in the NFL. So that just watching them play doesn't really bode, and fight on the field just doesn't really bode well to having that support system. But like, I don't know all the details in the Browns case. So it's kind of like, I don't know, like the word culture, when like general managers and coaches and owners, they love to throw that word around. And that's, and when you really start thinking about it, which I do a lot, it's like, what is the culture? Like, and you know, is your do you have a good locker room? What does any of that really mean when you really think about it? And so I don't know, like, I think there is a benefit and a power to having a good vibe and support system and quote unquote culture. But I don't, you can't just, it's an individual basis for every player. You're not just going to throw anybody in and think it's going to come out 100% success rate.
Yeah, there's something you said for football guys tend to, you know, I mean, look, they've risen to the highest level of the sport. They've been incredibly successful in doing so. And they kind of think too highly of themselves when it comes to non-football things. I mean, we picked on the Browns a little bit, but I mean, look, Aaron Hernandez played under Bill Belichick and Urban Meyer. Those are two of the greatest football coaches of all time, who obviously whatever support system they tried to set up just failed horribly and in horrific fashion. But I do want to bring it back to Dalvin, because the Vikings seem to have a fairly structured plan for him when he first got there, and the three guys, there was Teddy Bridgewater, who is still the quarterback there, still the starting quarterback, and if you didn't know, Dalvin grew up in Opa-locka down in the Miami area. Teddy Bridgewater is from Liberty City. Those are two. Extremely poverty-ridden neighborhoods. They were aggressively segregated during the Jim Crow era. Those are tough places to grow up. That's a hard upbringing. So it was Bridgewater, it was Xavier Rhodes, another Miami guy, and also a Florida State guy, and then Terrence Newman, who is old, and is a good guy.
He's just old.
He was just an old guy.
Yeah. So when the Vikings drafted Dalvin, I got a chance to talk to Teddy Bridgewater after his final start this year as New Orleans quarterback. I got a chance to talk to him, and he told me that as soon as they drafted Dalvin, who he had already known from childhood and knew his family pretty well from, you know, playing football with Dalvin's older brother, when the Vikings drafted him, he right away the next day, called up the equipment manager and said, I've got to be, his locker has to be right next to mine. I want that rookie right next to me. And I asked him, you know, why he did that. And he acknowledged, he said, I knew, you know, coming into the league, he had those red flags. And I wanted to show him, you know, how to behave, basically, like how to act in the NFL, how to handle being an NFL player. So he really took it upon himself individually. It's not like someone told Teddy, we're going to put Dalvin's locker right next to you on purpose. Here's why. It was more Teddy requesting that. And then on the other side of Dalvin was Terrence Newman, who was 39 years old at the time and had played for years and years and years. So it was really the best situation in terms of locker placement that they probably could have had for him, because, you know, he's got one guy who he can relate to on a personal level and has known for a long time in Teddy Bridgewater. And then on the other side, he has this veteran who has done everything right in his career and is sort of an example of, you know, how to have a long career, first of all, and how to make it and succeed. So, you know, and one thing that didn't make the story that was actually hilarious that Dalvin told me that I just remembered about Terrence Newman is that, so Terrence, like, I think in like 2015, he had like joked to Vikings reporters that the secret to his longevity was red wine. And that he drank a lot of red wine.
Yep.
And so it kind of became like a thing with Terrence Newman. And like, there were like a bunch of different stories about like him introducing teammates to wine and like being like a wine connoisseur, whatever. What is the word for that? There's a word for someone who's like good with wine. I can't think of it.
Like the wine taster, like the sommelier, is that it?
Yes, yes. So there were all these stories about him and his palate. And so I was asking Dalvin, I'm like, so how did like Terrence influence you? And he was like, well, first of all, he really got me to try a lot of new things. And I was like what? And he's like, well, like wine. And I was like, what? And I was like, classic Terrence. So apparently Dalvin had like never tried red wine and so thought he didn't like it, or maybe had tried it once a while ago and was like, ew, it's gross. And Terrence was like, it's just because you haven't tried a good one, Dalvin. And so Terrence like brought him like two or three bottles of red wine like the next day and like had Dalvin drink them. And so basically now Dalvin really likes red wine, and it's all because of Terrence Newman getting him to try some new things.
Really?
Yeah, so that was a detail that's like the uncut version.
Yeah,
wasn't important enough to make the story, but it was cute. Yeah, so they really surrounded him with the veteran players that he needed, and Xavier Rhodes has been huge on him. And he told me that Rhodes was basically, he's been like tough love, like really hard on him. And I think that was good for him. I think he needed that because, you know, when you get injured, when you tear your ACL. You can have a pity party and really think like, oh, woe is me, you know, like I'm never going to get back to the field. Like this sucks. But Rhodes kind of kept him like focused and you got to rehab. You got to get through this. Like, here's how you do it. That kind of stuff. So, and then the other thing that I think was really important for him and I found kind of interesting in my reporting was, the Vikings running backs coach, Kennedy Polamalu. He has a really unique relationship with Dalvin.
And he's to the point, and for those of you wondering, he's the uncle of Troy, by the way.
Oh yes. Yeah. I was about to say that and I totally forgot. Yeah, there is a relation. He's not a random Polamalu in the league. Anyway, so Kennedy is like this crabby, grumpy looking guy. He's real gruff. He doesn't really like to do interviews. But as soon as I sat down with him and started talking about Dalvin, I mean, he just went on and on and on. And the only reason we stopped talking is because he had to go to a coach's meeting. And so you could tell he loves Dalvin and they have a very close relationship. And as I said earlier, you know, Dalvin's pretty closed off and guarded. But once you do gain his trust, you're in his circle, like you're close to him. And Kennedy has broken into that. And, you know, Dalvin told me Kennedy is in his circle of people that he really trusts and he can be vulnerable with him. And, you know, sometimes Dalvin has family things going on or personal issues. Like I think it was last year, 2018. It's actually his uncle, but they were raised like brothers because they're around the same age. Mm-hmm. He was shot, and he ended up surviving in a miracle. Like he was shot somewhere around the neck, I think, and he ended up being okay. But he was shot like 3 days before the season started, and this was when Dalvin was coming off his ACL, so this was going to be a big moment for him, and he really wanted to fly back to Miami and like be with his brother. But you know, his grandma convinced him like, don't come out. But Kennedy was really instrumental in realizing like where Dalvin was at, like what he needed, talking to him during that really hard time for him. And so Dalvin's able to like tell Kennedy, you know, if something's going on at home, he'll let him know. And then Kennedy's able to, you know, either scale back his reps in practice because he knows, you know, he's not all mentally here with us today. Like he needs a little bit of a break. Or he's able to just talk him through it. And they call each other all the time when they're not at the facility together, and they text a lot. And so that just kind of stood out to me as an important thing for him, because Dalvin even told me like it's so much better that I'm able to talk to him about things, like because sometimes I just need to like let him know where I'm at and let him know where my mind is at, and then I feel a lot better afterwards. So that stood out to me as something that's really helped him as far as a support system in Minnesota.
And Kennedy kind of thought there was a silver lining to the ACL injury, because one thing with Dalvin and one thing a lot of people in the immediate aftermath of that 2017 draft after the Vikings took him, there's kind of this line of thinking of like, oh, you know, he had trouble during his teenage years. If you get him away from Miami, that'll be good for him. Now, Dalvin disputes that, but you know, he was rehabbing up in Minneapolis because of the ACL injury.
Yeah, Kennedy told me, you know, obviously when you have NFL money and you're going back to Miami is a fun place to be. There's a lot to do there. And so as most of us know, so Kennedy pointed out, he was like, I think it was really good for him to be in Minnesota to learn how to spend an off season as an NFL player, how to take care of your body, how to be serious about your job, even though it's not during the season. And he thought it was really good for him to be in Minnesota for all those reasons you just said, because of the perception that most people had, including the Vikings, that he needed to get away from his circle of friends in Miami and in Tallahassee. So I thought that was interesting. I think it probably did help him to mature and learn how to live life as a professional football player and to take it really seriously. But the other interesting part is, like, you know, he went back to Miami last offseason. And when I was there doing the story, an older brother and a few friends were visiting for a game. And that happens pretty frequently. And, you know, they're all from back home. And you know, he spent all of the last off season there, and he'll rent a spot down there. So he still spends a fair amount of time in Miami, and he's super proud of where he's from. That's like one of the main things about him. He loves his roots. He's really proud of the area that he's from and his upbringing. So he's very adamant that is not what the problem was for him. And he doesn't really understand why people think that about him. And I think like the fact that, you know, he was there last offseason and is still very close to most people that he was close to at that time, maybe he's right, you know? Maybe it wasn't the problem, because he's made it a few years now, still being connected to that and being okay as far as we know.
I was going to say, he made the point to you, he's like, I went to college in Tallahassee, like, it's the same state, but they're not very close to each other.
It's like 8-hour drive or something, like 7 or 8 hour drive. But that was definitely the impression that scouts had, because I think when they were doing all of their, you know, talking to people close to him and talking to coaches at Florida State, like, people were telling them he was having friends visiting Tallahassee that were leading to him not making the greatest decision. So that was kind of where that was coming from.
So when he, I guess sort of to the same point, when he was arriving in Minnesota, I mean, they were, especially the PR department, was ready for, like, you know, sort of a high-maintenance reclamation project type of guy, and it just, it wasn't really the case.
Yeah, they, you know, in my reporting for the story, I talked a lot with their PR staff because they know him really well, and obviously when you're doing a story, that's who you work with. So I was talking, I had a lot of conversations with them about Dalvin, and one thing they just kept repeating was how, like you said, they were prepared for kind of like an undertaking of, you know, let's remake this guy's reputation. Like, let's show, you know, America and the rest of the NFL that he's a great guy. And I think they thought it was going to be a lot of work, and it was going to take a detailed plan and a detailed vision to get there, to change that narrative about him that had appeared so bad in the pre-draft process. But, you know, as soon as he got to Minnesota is basically when they realized, like, oh, we don't have to put any extra effort in this at all. Like, this is going to be easy and natural because this kid is serious about this, and he's humble, and he's ready to go to work, and he's ready to do whatever we ask him, basically. And, you know, one thing they told me was that they were super impressed with him from the get-go because he was responsible enough away from the facility to call into the radio shows that he had scheduled, or to, you know, FaceTime in for a network broadcast, which doesn't seem like it's a lot. Doesn't seem like it would be that hard to do. But I know firsthand how hard it is for these PR directors sometimes to, like, get a player to call a reporter when they were supposed to. Like, yeah, it can become, as soon as they leave the facility, you kind of lose control over them as from a PR standpoint. So it can be really difficult to get something as simple as that done. So they were really impressed because he never had a problem with that. Like, he was responsible to do those things. So to them, that was like a huge sign of his maturity and, you know, maybe his growth. And then the other thing too that I forgot to say earlier, but is related to this, Terrence Newman, he had no idea why Dalvin had fallen to the second round. He was literally like, what the hell? How did we get this player? Like, this guy's really good. Like, what happened? Why wasn't he drafted in the first round? You know, he hadn't been reading everything that everybody else was. He had no idea about the red flags. And he said to me, like, repeated this several times in our interview. He said, you know, I was shocked to find out, like, the reasons that he fell to the second round, because to him, Dalvin was a model rookie. He was like, I was so impressed. He was so quiet. He was so serious. He was so hardworking, you know, didn't complain, was just there to, like, get the job done, basically. And he was just really surprised to, you know, find out about those red flags.
You know what I think the key is to his life in Minneapolis? He has everything he needs in his apartment, which is a TV and a yeah, Papa Shot. A Papa
That's
Shot
right.
hoop. That's all you
the
need.
The Papa Shot. That was literally, like, the only thing that he had. Like, I mean, it wasn't like a bachelor pad with no furniture or something, but it was, like, super low-key, you know, like a one-bedroom apartment. Nice apartment, but mm-hmm. nothing that you would expect, like, a star, you know, somebody who's, like, leading the league in rushing, or back and forth leading the league in rushing, to live in. Very, very, very low-key. But that's kind of like how he is. He's a homebody. He spends so much time in his apartment. He loves to nap. That's his main joy in life. He's got to get in that daily nap. And sometimes he'll nap for 2 hours, which to me is a little too long.
A little excessive.
Yeah, like I have to go, like, you know, 40-minute power nap is kind of if I nap for any longer than 40 minutes, it's like I might as well just sleep
now
until tomorrow.
Sleeping. Yep.
Yeah, like, let me just wake up tomorrow. This day is over. But he loves to nap, and he, you know, he actually, like, cut short our photo shoot because he needed to nap, which was awesome. I loved it. I was like, yeah, man, you know, like, follow your heart. Yeah, and then, you know, I think he enjoys going out to eat, but other than that, he's got a really, like, you know, chill life in Minneapolis now.
So I'm going to make sort of my final filibuster obnoxious point that you all will hate about criminal justice and neuroscience and that sort of stuff. And then I'll sort of hand the floor back to you, Caitlin. But, you know, we kind of tend to lose sight of these guys. They're young. These are very young men in this league. There's a study published in the Journal of Neuroscience that looked changes in white brain matter, which is that supports impulse control and other types of cognitive functions. But basically what they found is you're still growing white matter. You're still increasing white matter up to, you know, as old as like age 32. You know, and usually it peaks around like age 37. So what that kind of says in a general sense, and if you couldn't tell, I'm not a neuroscientist, but you are kind of not fully mature until your mid to late 30s. And for some guys, it's even later. I mean, you know, one of the researchers, Catherine LaBelle, had said for that study, like, you can't look at a brain scan and, like, tell someone's age. You can't look at a brain scan and be like, oh, this is an 18-year-old's brain. Like, everyone's brain changes at a different rate. And for our purposes, sort of the layman way of saying it is, like, everyone matures differently at a different rate. Sometimes you don't mature until your mid-20s or your late-20s or your early 30s. And it's not to say, you know, it's not to defend some of the really terrible things that he did during his teenage years, but it's just sort of to say, you know, that is, you know, the things he did at 16 are not the things he'll do at 26, are not the things he'll do at 36, and we don't know Dalvin Cook 100%. You went out there and tried, you know, you talked to a lot of people and people vouch for him. And that's kind of, you know, it's a combination of that and sort of gut instinct when you end up doing stories like this. He's 24 years old. He did regrettable things, terrible things in the past. He might in the future. But, you know, for a lot of people, they don't. They change. They mature.
This is true. We can't really say, that's the hard part about the story, is like you can't ever say with 100% certainty that he's a great guy. Like, I mean, I would probably say with 100% certainty that you're a great guy, but do I really know?
Well,
no.
I'm older than 37, so.
Oh, okay. Good point. So you can't, but I'm younger than 37, so you could not say that I am a great gal because we really don't know yet. Because I'm not fully mature with my white brain matter.
There you go.
So, you know, with the story, like, it's always kind of a risk. But, you know, we talked to a lot of people who insist that he is a great guy with 100% certainty. And we looked for people who would say otherwise. And, you know, for one instance, one person contacted me after the story was published. And they did actually have a bad impression of Cook based off of an interaction when he was at Florida State. So around the same time as all these other incidents were occurring. But this person was actually really open to the idea that Dalvin has changed and that he has matured and he has grown. And, you know, they actually said they like thanked me, you know, for writing the story because it helped change their idea of him, which was based off of one interaction several years ago. So that was really interesting to me. And it kind of, you know, reminds me of his grandma, Betty Cook, who had a great quote in this story. And, you know, she was very close to everything happening in the pre-draft process because a lot of teams were talking to her, obviously, as part of their research and kind of investigation on Dalvin. And Betty said, you know, a kid may have made some bad choices, but they grow up. And she said they were so busy, they being, you know, scouts and NFL teams, they were so busy worrying about his past that they couldn't see what was ahead. And I thought that was such a good take because it's true. Like it is easy to get so caught up on, you know, a rap sheet, you know, someone's record. But I think the thing that, you know, Rick Spielman, the Vikings general manager, what he kind of stressed to me was like, they looked into all those incidents and what they came away from was like somebody who was misunderstood and somebody who had been in the wrong place at the wrong time, and someone who had matured and grown and now realizes I can't be in these situations anymore. And that was kind of, you know, Rick Spielman's point. And when he got Dalvin on the phone on the morning of the second round, he was able to ask him about that. And I think that may have been the only time, you know, without having been in on all of these conversations that Dalvin was having with NFL teams, I think that was probably the only time, or maybe the time where he was the most expansive, because I think it became real to him, like, oh, I wasn't drafted in the first round.
Yeah.
Now I've got to just answer whatever they ask me. Like, I have to just do this now. I think it sunk into him that night when he didn't get the call on the night of the first round, because he was really disappointed about that. So I think, like, on the next morning when he talked to Rick Spielman, I think he was finally vulnerable with Rick. And because that's how Rick described it to me, is that he answered everything that he needed to hear from him. And that's why he then felt good about drafting him. But then the other interesting thing I forgot to say earlier was that after the story was written, I was talking to a scout about it, and he was like, well, yeah, I mean, that was like the greatest choice by the Vikings, but also such an easy choice for them because they didn't have a first round pick that year. So they didn't have to decide in the first round, like, oh, are we going to use a first round pick on this running back that we really like, but we're not 100% sure on?
Yeah.
So instead of, like, Leonard Fournette, who was probably drafted about where maybe Dalvin would have been drafted that year in the first round had he not had the red flags, like, his contract was so much more than Dalvin's. Like, Fournette's was, you know, $27.15 million, whereas Cook's was $6.35 million. So just from, like, a monetary standpoint, like, yes, like, the Vikings, when you use a second round draft pick on anyone, like, that's a pretty valuable draft pick. But if Dalvin didn't turn out, it wasn't like a first round bust where they had, you know, given him a huge contract or anything like that. So I think, like, it was a pretty easy no-brainer decision for the Vikings because they loved his talent. And then there he was in the second round. Why not?
Kaylin, you're about to get me started on the rookie wage scale. So this show is going to go like 3 more hours now.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Can't get Gary started on that
topic.
It.
We'll save it for another time. Kaylin, thanks for joining us on this first iteration of this show. I think we'll do
Thank
more.
Thank you. I loved it.
If you want to check out Kaylin's piece, the headline is "The Rise of Dalvin Cook: What Happened When the Red Flags Stopped Waving." It is a sequel at its heart. You can follow it without reading the first piece from 2017, but if you do want to read that one, that is "Dalvin Cook and the Stories Behind the Red Flags." That is a Robert Klemko piece, and Robert now works at a local newspaper covering some Pop Warner football, I believe.
Just your average local paper.
Yeah.
Nothing special.
Yep. All right. That's going to be a wrap for this one. The MMQB NFL Thursday show is me, Gary Gramling. Thanks to Kaylin Kaler for joining us this week. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.